Hi, folks. Welcome to an episode of Movies and a Meal, the podcast where we gather to talk about movies and other stuff all over a meal. It's Keith here doing the hosting news this week, joined by host by Ben.
Hello.
And Brad.
What's up?
It's a big week this time out, of course, with Phase 5 of the MCU being launched with Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, starring Paul Rudd, Evangeline Lilly, Michelle Pfeiffer, Michael Douglas, and, of course, the rapidly rising Jonathan Majors. But first up is a look at the Amazon Prime romantic comedy, Someone I Used to Know, from the husband and wife duo of Dave Franco and Alison Brie. So, first up, Brad, tell us what this movie's all about.
Summer is always courtesy of IMDb. On a trip to her hometown, workaholic Allie reminisces with her ex, Sean, and starts to question everything about the person she's become. Things only get more confusing when she meets Cassidy, who reminds her of the person she used to be.
Well, that reveals a lot, but not too much. That's a pretty good summary, and that tells you a lot what this is about. But I went into this one with high hopes for several reasons. First off is, I like smart romantic comedies, and when this one works, that's what it is. But it's also a mini community reunion of sorts. Alison Brie, of course, is the main star, and Danny Pudi, who I always love, is one of the supporting roles. So, you know, I'm team six seasons in a movie for sure, and so I was hooked all right away. And I'm mostly glad I watched it for this one. You know, in it, Brie plays the creator and showrunner of some reality fluff called Desert Island, and that's all played for pretty great comic effect. What launches it all, I'm not spoiling too much here, is when the show gets canceled and she returns home to seek solace with her mother in her hometown of Leavenworth, Washington. And this much, Someone I Used to Know definitely gets right. We've all been in a career crossroads like that, and Brie, who co-wrote this with her husband and director, Dave Franco, dives into it with a realness that's real refreshing. We of course see the admittedly pretty standard rom-com trick, here when she runs through an old flame, played both charmed by Jay Ellis, who fans will know most recently from his role as Payback in Top Gun Maverick. They spend a PG-rated but fun night together visiting all their haunts, one of the movie's best stretches, and this is a little spoiler here, but you have to know this going in, only to find out in the morning that he's engaged. Without spoiling any more, rom-com fans will know how similar this is to My Best Friend's Wedding. But here, thanks to Brie and Franco, it adds a lot of insight about growing up and embracing the joys and sorrows of life. So I don't want to spoil any more of the plot. Just know that Danny Pudi is really fun also, as a longtime friend of both of them. The real revelation here, though, is Kiersey Clemons, an indie movie favorite I've loved for a long time, from way back to Hearts Beat Loud, and she was also in the 2022 Sundance flick, Am I Okay? Here, the movie really gets much of its spark from how she and Brie's Allie both challenge and learn from each other as she plays the fiancée of Jay Ellis' character. They kind of challenge each other and learn from each other throughout the movie, and that's what really gets the smartest part. I didn't look at the overall Rotten Tomato numbers, because I don't like to spoil it for Brad, but I know people are mixed on this one, and I liked it a lot more than most people. It is really a very familiar story, but it's given new life by Brie and Franco and all their friends, and the way it looks at life and growing up and dealing with its joys and its challenges, I really liked it, and I will give this an affectionate 3 stars. So if you like rom-coms, check it out on the Amazon Prime, for sure.
Rotten Tomatoes, Keith? Critics and audience?
Well, I looked at the IMDb overall, so I don't know the Rotten Tomatoes number, but I will go a little harsh with the critics. I'll go 60. I will go fans. You know, fans, the community, you know, audience is not the rom-com audience, but they love community. I will go 70.
Flip the numbers, Keith, you'd be pretty close. Critics, 73%, 70 okay. Reviews. Audience, 62%, 100-plus reviews.
Yeah, people were a little hard on Alison Brie, but, you know, she wrote this from the heart, along with Dave Franco, and I appreciated that. And I know it's not for everybody, but it's a pretty good rom-com. Mm.
Critics' consensus by Rotten Tomatoes. While it might have been more satisfying with a sharper focus, Somebody I Used to Know is a funny, uniquely nuanced rom-com with some interesting things to say.
Okay, so, and this is on Amazon Prime, right?
Yes, it is. And so if you like rom-coms with a little smarts to it, you can do much worse than this. Check it out for sure.
Okay. Mm. Well, let's talk about a movie that is on the big screen this week, and that is Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania. You know, Keith already mentioned the cast list, and it is the, geez, what are we now, the 31st episode in the Marvel Cinematic Universe TV thing. So this is the beginning of Phase 5, and is the third movie in the Ant-Man trilogy. Paul Rudd is back, Evangeline Lilly is back, Jonathan Majors, Catherine Newton, and of course, Michelle Pfeiffer and Michael Douglas. Those are the main headliners, and there's some other people we'll talk about. But Brad, what's this movie about?
Summer is always courtesy of IMDb. When Scott Lang and Hope Van Dyne, along with Hope's parents Hank Pym and Janet Van Dyne, and Scott's daughter Cassie, are accidentally sent to the Quantum Realm, they soon find themselves exploring the realm, interacting with strange new creatures.
You know, this movie, like I said, is the kickoff to Phase 5. When the movie's credits were rolling up, you know, Brad turned to me and like, well, what'd you think? And I think all Ant-Man movies are good. They don't ever really approach great, but they also are never terrible. Mm-hmm. This movie feels more like a vehicle without spoiling too much, to introduce Jonathan Majors, Kang, who we saw at least one version in the Loki TV series and is set up to be the big bad, kind of the Thanos for this next large phase of the Marvel movies. And for that, I enjoyed it. Jonathan Majors, fantastic. It's always nice to see Michelle Pfeiffer in there. But Paul Rudd, who is the star of this franchise, kind of takes a back seat. And that's fine. That's fine. But
Don't get started on Evangeline Lilly, though.
Which sucks because, I mean, her character in the second movie and this movie, I mean, she's in the title. It's Ant-Man exactly. and the Wasp. And she doesn't really get a lot of playing time. But
little spoiler here, but friend of the podcast, Matt, he's got some thoughts. And that, one of those thoughts is exactly what we've been saying.
Keith, I agree with you pretty much. But there was a lot to pull off with this one. I mean, you brought back not only the OG Avengers, but close. And you're launching Phase 5. And, of course, you're right. You know, the other people are going to get lost in shadows when you have Michael Douglas and Michelle Pfeiffer. And she's really, we'll get into it, she's really the heroine of this movie. And it's pretty incredible. And, you know, I've always kind of loved Peyton Reed. I love that also he's listed on IMDb as TV director Peyton Reed. These movies are a real accomplishment. Also, like his earlier fun movies, like Bring It On and Down With Love, that's kind of what's missing from this movie, unfortunately. There are funny parts, and there are darkly funny parts in the second half. But I will say, the first 50 minutes of this movie or so, before Kang appears, it's visually stunning, but I think they were just kind of in love with themselves, making that part. I could use more levity, but overall, the movie is a real accomplishment for what it had to achieve, and I liked it.
Yeah, just to piggyback off that before I kick it to Brad, I agree. You know, the Ant-Man movies are kind of the funnier of the MCU franchises, but I'd be hard-pressed to tell you in our audience there were many laughs. And actually, Brad kind of laughed at some stuff, and I think he kind of jump-started some other people to laugh. But there were some times where, like, I can't hear because people are dying, well, kind of thing.
There's a character we'll get into in the second half when Brad really started laughing, and I'm with you. That character brought darkly comic spirit to it, but it was in the last, like, third of the movie.
Yeah, you know? he is also a very controversial character, too, yeah. for some. So
what about you, Brad? What'd you think?
The Ant-Man movies, like you mentioned, they're not going to blow your socks off, but I mean they're at best good and at worst average. This one falls in that same category for me. So I think we mentioned Jonathan Majors. He is definitely excellent in this, and this movie is really a character for a vehicle for not only himself but also Michelle Pfeiffer as Janet Van Dyne. Honestly, she's stealing a lot of scenes in this movie, and Paul Rudd as Scott Lang and Evangeline Lilly as Hope Van Dyne, they're pushed in the background for the most part. There's second half of the movie, they're given more to do, but honestly, it's nowhere near what you think. And newcomer Catherine Newton is pretty good as Cassie Lang. I gotta say, she's not quite maybe my secret MVP, but I mean, she holds her own well in the movie, especially with the likes of Michelle Pfeiffer and even Jonathan Majors. There's one scene when we get to spoilers that I just was an awesome scene, just made me just smile from ear to ear. All in all, like I said, good movie.
Friend of the podcast, Matt, had some notes, so if you want to read those, and then we can circle back on some other non-spoiler things.
Quick summary, as he has listed here, from this is from Friend of the Podcast, Matt. So he said, it's an Ant-Man movie that is a classic science fiction story, like some of the classic Ant-Man and the Wasp stories from Tales to Astonish, but unfortunately has been done better in the MCU by movies like Guardians of the Galaxy and Thor Ragnarok.
We'll save what his actual rating is, but we'll just talk a bit more. Yeah, I mean, Jonathan Majors, he's all that he's cracked up to be, basically. Mm-hmm. In some cases, I would even say that it even feels like he's in a different movie. And it's weird to have him opposed to Ant-Man, because Paul Rudd is, you know, obviously he's never played really serious for this Ant-Man series, and maybe that's the reason for the contrast. Maybe that's what they want to. There's a scene basically where where Jonathan Majors Kang is threatening Paul Rudd, and we've never seen Scott Lang in that kind of real dire straits. The second movie, I know Keith, you just saw that one. There's almost no bad guy in there, and exactly. Then we go to this one where it's really serious, exactly. And you know, Kang is basically just like, hey, if you don't do this thing, I'm going to kill your daughter.
I don't know if they did this on purpose, but this is the first time Paul Rudd actually looks his age. He looks like a haggard, you know, 40, 50, where he normally looks eternally boyish, like 35. They probably did a little bit on purpose, because you're right. He needed some heft to face up with Kang, and it was kind of an odd fit.
Jonathan Majors there is Kang. I think that really just pulled out the badassery from Scott Lang. Like you said, he's more of the comic relief. I mean, the most serious he gets probably in the first movie, when Yellowjacket's trying to kidnap his daughter. That's probably the most serious he is, and it's notched up to 11 here.
Catherine Newton as Cassie Lang, I liked her enough. And Marvel seems to be having a pattern where their younger heroes are just like, they're just like full of pluck. It would be nice for them to mix it up a little bit, just from like, wow, this is great. Because she's channeling, same as Haley Steinfeld's Hawkeye in the TV series. You know, they're just really in awe of things. Like, wow, I'm big. Like, wow, this is cool. And, you know, it's fine, but eventually we're going to have to, there's got to be other people, because not everyone's like that.
But I'll argue with you that I think also in this movie, and like Haley Steinfeld, they're the moral compass. They're trying to do good. Mm-hmm. And in this one, your opposite is Michelle Pfeiffer as Janet Van Dyne. Now, I won't get into why she wants to kind of get out of there, but they want to kind of just leave them alone and just let them do their own thing. Like, you don't want to mess with the environment, because it's like in the wild. Like, you mess with the environment, you could cause extinction of a species. But she's like, well, we got to help them because we're the good guys. So she's the one that's trying to just bring the moral compass back to the good side, where the veteran superheroes, I guess you could say, are like, well, it's their people. Maybe we won't do this. Let's just get you to safety first. So
one of the reasons I was a little upset that the first 50 minutes or so is so cluttered and just a jumbled mess is it introduces pretty good characters. I really like William Jackson Harper, always. He's great on he's great in The Good Place. He's good in indie movies. And his telepath, Quaz, was a pretty fascinating character who gets about 5 to 10 minutes in this movie. And also, the rebel leader, Gentora, played by Kitty O'Brien, is very good. She's more of a rough, you know, female heroine than
Cassie Lang.
Cassie Lang, yes, sorry. You know, she has more of an edge to her, and she had more to do. Especially, she made the rebellion at the end fun. But I could have used a little more of those supporting characters also.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's either all or nothing. Either you give them more to do or don't use them at all, really.
Yeah, and I think Quaz will be back, and Gentora. But still, it was good to introduce them. But yeah, we could have had more of that.
This is the opening of Phase 5. And, you know, we've been doing this Marvel thing now for 15 years. And we're just fully embracing the weirdness of it, you know. We're going to have back-to-back space movies with space aliens. Actually, all three of them, really, because... Mm-hmm. We're going to have this movie. They're not technically space aliens, but Quantumania is definitely science fiction. Obviously, we're going to do that with Guardians. And the Marvels movie definitely, I assume, will deal with some space stuff and aliens and whatnot. And, you know, we're kind of far from just Ant-Man or from the original Ant-Man with, like, okay, we got to steal a suit and we're just, you know, we're shrinking, you know, tanks into toys for the keychain and stuff like that. So it's interesting what they're going to do now. I mean... Basically, you're either really all in on the MCU or it's time to jump off, because it's only going to get more fantastical.
The comedy in this movie, at least for me, I think it landed decently, I think. I think at least it didn't affect the tone. Like for me, like Thor Love and Thunder, I think the comedy affected the tone of the movie. This one, I don't think it takes away from the seriousness of the serious parts of the movie. So I don't know if you all disagree with that or not, but...
I mean, I kind of... Some of the kitsch of the Ant-Man movies... Keith, you know, you mentioned that. They're really the most kid-friendly movies, I think. I always just got a kick of the shrinking and growing, you know? It's just like, no matter how many times you do it, like, I think it's in the second one, someone throws a salt shaker and they make it big and then, you know, they shrink cars. And that's funny, but we don't get to see any of that in this for a lot of reasons. And I don't know.
Yeah, I missed it, but I will say the second half, it did get funnier with a darker edge. There's a scene that... Scott Lang gets into, we'll talk about when the spoilers are off, that's really good, and there's character in the second half. But, you know, I did, like Ben said, miss some of that mirth, but I did appreciate the dark comic spirit of the second half of it. Mm.
Yeah. And I think the action pieces in this were good, too. I think both the CGI and the actual hand-to-hand, we'll get into the actual hand-to-hand, because it's few and far between, especially for an Ant-Man movie, but...
That last fight was probably as brutal
a
fight that I've seen in Ant-Man movies, or maybe... Maybe since, like, Captain America... Without spoiling it too much, but, like, Captain America Winter Soldier. I mean, it was...
It was definitely brutal. Maybe Shang-Chi. Shang-Chi had some decent hand-to-hand action, but...
And as Ben said at the end of the movie, without spoiling also, this movie could have ended a lot darker.
Yeah.
But this is an Ant-Man movie, after all.
Yeah, so,
I mean, there were definitely some times in this movie that I really felt like Scott Lang was in peril. I mean, it really...
Yeah.
Which, I just... You never... think about. Especially, again, the second movie, there wasn't any real bad guy, really.
Yeah, and that part I appreciate. I like him and being in sexual peril.
Yeah. Oh. Well, but yeah, I agree. The final fight, I didn't know if that'd be spoilers or not, but that final fight
I mean, all Marvel movies
have there has to be a fight. Yeah.
Yeah, so that final fight was definitely one of the more brutal ones that I've seen, especially for, like you said, an Ant-Man movie. So. Mm-hmm.
If we don't have any more general things, I think we should do the ratings and everything like that. Mm-hmm. So I'll just go first. I'm going to give it a 3. I think that our expectations, again, this is the 31st movie in the MCU. Our expectations have grown because the first 23, you know, that first Infinity War saga was so good. Our tastes have grown. Our expectations have grown. And not this is a bad movie, but, you know, we just have to keep pushing ourselves a little bit. Mm-hmm. So it's a 3 for me. I'll steal Keith's line, affectionate 3 for me.
Exactly. I love that line. But I will go sort of similar, but I'll go 3.5. Even though I really didn't like half the movie, the second half was really good. And you can't say enough how good Jonathan Majors is. He's here. And he was almost Shakespearean in his performance. And for that, I'll give it 3.5 stars.
I agree. I gave it 3.5 stars. Action pieces was good. There were some storytelling spots where I was kind of shaking my head. We'll get into them in spoilers, but there was some things that just threw me off that kind of dropped some stars for me. But it's definitely a good Ant-Man movie. And it's in the vein of basically the other two movies. Like, I mean, in my ratings, I gave the first Ant-Man a 3. I gave the second one a 2.5. So it's 2.5, 3, 3.5. I mean, it's right in that average to good range. So
I'm a little surprised, Brad. I got to say, I liked the first Ant-Man. I thought number 2 was really good.
Really?
Yes. It's... Watching it again, I'd give that a 3.5, too.
I think they're all 3s.
Yeah.
But good 3s.
I just like the ghost character and what it brought out. And anyway, we're going a little diversion here, but no.
Yeah, I like the ghost character, but I thought they could have done a lot more with her. It seemed like the movie just meandered. There was no main villain. It was just like they were just killing time to kill time, honestly. So for me anyway. But and like I said, I might have to watch it again, but if I watch it again, it might be better. But
so Matt gave your rating too, right? So what's his rating?
Matt gave it a 3.5, and just to mention here, no spoilers, he said, I'm sure you guys will talk about how amazing Jonathan Majors is. I'll just give a thumbs up on the support. So yeah. So he gave it a 3.5 as well.
Okay, so all 3.5s, and then me at 3. But that's fine, whatever.
Yeah.
Ben, you gave it an affectionate.
I did.
Yeah, we're all in the same ballpark.
So that's like a 3.25. Yeah, so you're borderline. So.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, again, if somebody wanted to talk trash about the Ant-Man series, I would defend it. I also enjoyed it. I thought, and maybe too, because like Ant-Man has been on TNT or something like that for the last 2 years, and I always just watch it. It's just a fun movie. It's a fun movie.
And just a fun fact, people need to remember, Peyton Reed only got this movie after they fired Edgar Wright. Mm-hmm. So that's the fact that he's carried for these 3 movies and he's made into this is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, coming full circle, you know, Peyton Reed was announced as a Fantastic Four guy and then he got fired off that, so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But also, non-spoiler things, shout to Baskin-Robbins.
Hell yeah. So.
All right, why don't we do Rotten Tomatoes and the box office and some of the other stuff, and then we can just talk openly about this movie. As far as Rotten Tomatoes go, I'm going to recuse myself because I was listening to a podcast about this movie, and they had mentioned that as a talking point about just where it sits in the overall MCU and our expectations. So I'm not going to guess, so I'll kick it over to Keith.
And actually, before we get into it, Matt has some thoughts on the Rotten Tomatoes as well. So critics and audience, Keith. Why don't you start off?
Well, I will say I didn't look, but I did look at the Washington Post, and I'm souring more and more than them. They gave it 1.5 stars. I mean, come on. So I think the critics are, I will go as high as 75, and I'll reverse it. I'll say the fans are, you know, there's people who crap on Ant-Man, but the hell with them. 65.
I will just say that when I was listening to the podcast, I think, I don't know, what audience it was attributed to, but the number I heard was 52%. It was around there. So
this is critics or
I can't remember if it was critics or audience, but I just know that one of the numbers was 52%.
Well, I'm being optimistic. That might be closer.
Well, do you want to give like an audience score or something or just
Well, I guess if I had to guess, audience scores are usually a little bit higher and more forgiving, so I'll go like 72.
Okay. Critics, 48%, 294 reviews. And we were talking beforehand on the show. That is actually 1% higher than The Eternals. So The Eternals is at 47% from the critics on Rotten Tomatoes.
And that's one of the lowest MCU
Yes, ones, it's right? One of the lowest MCU movies ever. So they gave this one a 48. So I don't know where they got it. Audience, 84%, 2,500 plus reviews. So, and real quick from Matt, he had some thoughts on this. He's like, the first Ant-Man was 83%. Ant-Man and the Wasp was 87%, and this one is 48%? That makes no sense. Mm-hmm. Even if this movie disappointed, it still has so many good things, including amazing action moments, emotional moments, good humor, and good acting. He has, in parentheses, amazing acting by Jonathan Majors. So,
and another, this was a, you know, jumping off point. It was a different kind of movie. But as a critic, you have to be able to deal with that. You have to know what Marvel's trying to do here, and they mostly pulled it off. So 48% is just shocking to me.
Yeah. And so maybe people are just, their expectations are so high, and when it's not met, then they're like, well, it sucks then. Which is a bad way to think about it.
Yes,
but the,
exactly.
But the problem is, you would think the audience score would reflect that. It's the critics that are the ones that are souring on it. So
I think from what I've read, the audience embraced the oddity of it, and they were ready for a little more of an edge to Ant-Man.
Yeah. You know?
So. It is a big contrast between the first two movies that's pretty grounded, and this one basically, you know, it's like 2 hours and maybe about an hour 40, or it's all on a green screen or the void or whatever it is, because it's you know, it's sci-fi, but yeah.
I do have a critic's consensus on it. As always, this is courtesy of Rotten Tomatoes. Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania mostly lacks the spark of fun that elevated earlier adventures, but Jonathan Majors' Kang is a thrilling villain poised to alter the course of the MCU.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I still don't understand how there'd be a 48 on that one. So it just
it boggles the mind.
Yeah.
But like I said, if you're a reviewer for the Washington Post, I don't know why you go to superhero movies, because they crap on them all the time, and it angers me.
Well, I mean, that's box office fair. I mean, it's either that or Top Gun Maverick. I mean, it's the popcorn ones that make all the movies, make the money. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they're the ones that are going to read it. But,
and again, if you're a critic, maybe you're looking at it through a different lens. And again, you know, this is year 15 of the MCU.
Yeah.
You want to do the box office too?
Yep, sure.
Then we can get into spoilers.
I think you can guess what was number one.
Okay, so Ant-Man was number one.
Yep. I'm gonna say that it did reach $100 million. I'm guessing.
Barely.
Okay.
$104 million 1 week. Number two, holding steady, Avatar The Way of the Water, $6.1 million this week. 10 week total, $658.4 million.
Which these two gentlemen went to see. I was surprised because you didn't not see Avatar 1, but you both liked it.
I saw it on TV. I saw nothing on TV.
So I didn't see the first one, but I understood enough just from osmosis and, you know.
They did kind of a recap. Yeah,
they did a recap.
And so. Puss in Boots, The Last Wish, in third, $5.26 million.
Oscar nominated Puss in Boots.
Yes. Nominated. 9 week total of $167.7 million. So I'm pretty sure that Oscar buzz is keeping it in the box office.
Hey, it got
so.
Your money, and maybe mine too. Keith actually before. He was on the hype train.
Well,
before.
I'm an anime guy.
So. Yeah, so. Number four is Magic Mike's Last Dance. $5.5 million, 2 week total of $18.9 million. So it's
fair enough.
In there, so. Number five is Knock at the Cabin. $3.9 million, 3 week total of $31 million.
It's only been out 3 weeks. I feel like we didn't review. I feel like it's been like six since we reviewed it.
Yeah, but that's a good number for M. Night Shyamalan for 3 weeks. That's good.
And then the other, I guess the other high point this week of movies that had debuted, if you want to say high point, debuting at eighth was Marlowe. First week total of $1.9 million. So
wow, I told these guys anecdotally, a friend of mine, so my father's, who's older age group, they went at like a 2 p.m. showing and said there were 40 people there. So apparently, people of a certain age do know Marlowe, and they're going to see this movie.
Yeah.
But the reviews were pretty horrendous.
And apparently, the I believe debuting in the theater this week. I don't have a place for it, but it was Winnie the Pooh. Was it Blood and Honey? Is that the horror movie?
I
think it's like $675,000. I think. I'm not sure that even came here.
Yeah, I don't know, but I hope not, because God knows.
All right, so I think it's time, Brad, for the spoilers.
Turn away! Shrink away now!
Okay, so I'll give the baseline spoiler summary. Our heroes are sucked back into the quantum realm, and it is revealed that Janet, who had been stuck in the quantum realm since before the first movie, had kind of unwittingly forged an alliance with Kang and basically empowered him to almost get out of exile, but when she was rescued, I guess, in the second movie, he was left there because she didn't want to support him and his world-conquering desires. And he basically just conquered that world and kind of ruled. And so she came back. And then, so they have a history. Kang captures Scott and Cassie, threatens Cassie in a very, probably one of the most intense scenes in the movie. Basically, he's like, I will kill your daughter if you don't do this for me. So,
and that's my most favorite scene in the movie.
Yeah, well...
It was the scene where they're in the cells, and you see Jonathan Majors make his appearance on the screen, just like in Loki. And just him talking just made... I just started smiling. I mean, it's just... It's an amazing thing. It's hard for a villain just to appear villainous... Just from his voice changing. It's an amazing thing. It's like Sir Ian McKellen, I think, in Magneto was definitely one where he captivated you with his voice in the X-Men movies. And I think Jonathan Majors is definitely the same. So
Jonathan Majors, if you watch any of his other movies, you know, Keith and I reviewed Devotion. Mm-hmm. He's going to be in Creed a couple weeks from now. He has an eloquence in his delivery. And you can really tell it's like him and the big bad from the first phase, Josh Brolin's Thanos. They're the top tier villain. Not only how they deliver, but also just like they're very convincing. And I don't know what it is. There's a magnetism about him. Like, even though like Kang is definitely evil in this movie, but you're like, I don't know. There's a charm to him that you're still like.
You have to be seductively evil.
Yes, that's a good word.
But not only that, I mean, it's like he said, he's like, hey, I'm here. Because my others, they're going to be like, I'm here to stop my others because my others are a whole lot worse than I am. Yeah. So, and if you think about it, that's a scary thought. So,
Well, you know, that really set up the end credits perfectly. We'll get to the end credits later, but this is the best 1-2 end credits I've seen in a long time. And, you know, if we're getting into the second half of it, the way it got better and better for me is when it introduced the darker side of the quantum, not only quantum realm, but of his abilities. That scene when Scott Lang is thrown into a sea of his own variants and they have to learn to work together to get into the core, that really caught the spirit of the quantum realm and of Kang perfectly for me.
We're in the spoiler, so Darren Cross, a.k.a., gosh, what's his name?
MODOK.
Nick Stahl. Sorry.
Corey Stahl.
Corey Stahl. Yeah. Comes back as MODOK in this. And the MODOK character, I mean, what can you do? He's a weird guy, so you just have to accept that this big floating head with a bunch of weapons and baby legs is in this.
In the comics, though, I don't know the comics MODOK. Is Darren Cross MODOK or I didn't think so, but it doesn't really matter.
No, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to me.
The MCU's done a good job of like introducing characters with little subtle changes to them. Like for instance, Ultron in the comics is made by
Hank Pym.
So, and in here, I mean, it's like Hank Pym wasn't even introduced when they had Ultron come in. So they had to change it up and they had Tony Stark and it fit perfectly. So this one, it fits perfectly as well, having him as MODOK, even though some people might not be happy with, I guess, the take on MODOK, because apparently it's
a ridiculous character. Yeah. What are you going to do?
So, I've not heard the problems. I just know that people are, I guess, upset on the take where I guess they consider him
who's
too
devoted
much
to MODOK.
In the comics, I mean, he is more of a badass in the comics than he is here. But I mean, he's still good here. I think he takes my underrated MVP in this. I think just going from a sadistic murderer, which he is. I mean, he's a mechanism.
Mechanism only designed for killing.
For killing, or something MODOK. Like that. Yeah.
Mechanized organism
designed only to kill.
For killing. Yeah. So that's in his name. So, but I mean, it just comes off as comedic relief, and I think it's well needed comedic relief. And I think especially the end scene where he is kind of killed off. I mean, we're in the spoilers, so they shouldn't have killed him. I think he could have turned out to be a pretty good either like sidekick or even another villain for a TV show or something.
Yeah,
but,
you know, it's Marvel and comic books. No one's ever really dead. They could probably find a way.
Exactly.
Friend of the podcast, Matt has an interesting thought here, and this one on
MODOK.
On MODOK, and this might upset some people, but I will go ahead and read it. He's like, MODOK would still have to be a better, more important adventure than Quicksilver, right? At least MODOK actually helped beat the bad guy. So,
yeah. But, you know, I appreciated it as a non-comic book kind of guy compared to you guys. I liked the MODOK TV series, my man Patton Oswalt. It was funny.
Yeah.
But MODOK is a seriously twisted character. Mm-hmm. And to bring it back as Darren Cross's giant head and to beat him not just a killer, but a gleeful killer, And this is a total spoiler, but the way that he dies, and he says he dies in Avenger, I just, you know, that he didn't die in Avenger, obviously, but he brought the biggest smile to my face.
That was the biggest laugh for Brad. Brad was, yeah,
Brad
like,
was out of control.
Brad Gaffall. You know? Yeah, and he kind of jumpstarts like, other people
he's
to
like,
laugh.
We were as close.
You almost jumped out of your seat, I saw.
Yeah, we were as close as brothers, and he starts touching his face, and I'm just like, oh my gosh. I was like, it's so funny just how delusional that was.
And I love Corey Stahl. He's an underrated actor, so that was a nice touch.
Yeah, it was a nice kind of redemptive arc for that character. Because, you know, I mean, it's true. It's just like when Cassie's like, this is the man who dressed as a bee and tried to kill me in my room when I was 6 years old. And now they're together. And, you know, she's the one, you know, you mentioned your moral compass, but she's the one who actually kind of centers Darren Cross, MODOK, maybe to be like, you don't have to be a bad guy, really, if you don't want to. You know, we mentioned in the non-spoilers, but I think the moment really of peril for Scott is towards the end when the guys, when the family's trying to get home, they jump through a portal, and Kang is like into a pretty brutal hand-to-hand combat with Scott. And, you know, it's just like this. The Ant-Man movies aren't known for hand-to-hand combat. It's not like Captain America, Winter Soldier. And Jonathan Majors is like peak form, you know. Yeah. He's like basically just reusing his skills from Creed. And and you can even see it in the commercials, but he is just kicking Scott's ass. It's really, I mean, it's like, it's,
well, I mean,
he's bloody and like, you know, his arm is, he's got him in an arm bar.
I mean, but think about it. I mean, Kang is a guy who's been outside time. I mean, he's peak
physical
form. He's a
mortal warrior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, so, and
Scott is just a thief. He's
Scott,
not really
Scott,
a fighter.
Scott's a thief who basically knows, basically, like, how to throw maybe a half-hearted punch. And not half-hearted, but
I mean, he's taught by Evangeline Lilly, and he's probably good to fight a regular person, but not a mortal god-type guy.
I did like that part of the final one, where it's like, you know that Kang has got the upper hand. And I mean, Jonathan Majors does an excellent job of showing that. In fact, I think some of his best scenes is when he just goes from calm to angry. From when he goes like 0 to 100, I think some of the best scenes. And I know Creed 3, we're probably going to have some of that too. So I'm really interested to see his performance in
2 weeks,
3,
right?
So.
Creed 3?
Yep. Okay, so what's Matt's nitpick?
Matt's nitpick, by the way, he has a least valuable person has to be Bill Murray.
This is on casting.
That was pretty bad.
He's like, what was he doing there? Why was he cast someone like him for such a random part?
To get some butts in the seats.
Yeah, maybe. I guess so. But his nitpick is, why couldn't Scott just get way bigger anytime he was stuck or needed to crush Kang or something like that? They're in this incredibly miniaturized space, so just get bigger. That's his nitpick question.
Sure.
So.
I mean, I enjoyed
this movie went a lot shorter.
I enjoyed the like kind of King Kong Godzilla part where he's just large and running amok against Kang's forces. That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Do we want to talk about the two post credit scenes? So
before we do that, I've got a little nitpick here with story, and I guess sort of more like how they've made Kang out. It's weird. I mean, it's just, he's a man who's outside time and has killed numerous people and Avengers, but somehow he couldn't figure out how to replicate or even sort of like work around Pym particles. It's like he had to get them in there to do that. It was a little baffling for me. It's just, also, they set up Kang as a main villain, which was great. That was excellent. And choosing Jonathan Majors is definitely one of the better choices they've done in choosing actors for a part. But his defeat felt a little bit underwhelming for me, especially when it was ants. I mean, you know, granted, it's an Ant-Man movie. Ants are going to be a part of it. I can understand that. But I mean, he's a man that was basically disintegrating people with just laser blast. And he couldn't find a way to just do a very radial disintegration of the ants. I mean,
you're right, but he's one variant of Kang. You don't know if this is the strongest variant. You don't know. We don't know any of these things yet. You're right.
He just got, again, like your boy Ultron and your boy Thanos in What If. Maybe he just got slipping. Plus, I mean,
he got slipping. Exactly.
I mean, plus, you know, it's just like you have a rush of ants, and then MODOK kind of sucker punches him a little bit. I mean, there's just a lot going on.
It's chaos.
So.
Yeah.
Even with the disintegration, why was he was using the beams on Scott and Hope, and they weren't disintegrating? I mean, was it the suits? I just assumed
the suits had armor.
I thought so.
The suits had armor and also plot armor, so they can't die.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. It's just
You read way too much into these things, Brad, but it's good.
Why was Tommy Boy the only salesman for that company?
Exactly.
Part of the movie. Because they all went to a shell. They were all accepted that they were going to sell anyway. So, but my cousin has a little bit of a thought, too. He's like, I don't know if it makes sense to have him be beaten his first two appearances, also referencing Loki, but then have it not be the real Kang that the Avengers will face in Kang Dynasty. It's an interesting choice, but because it's kind of how these characters were introduced in the comics, but I don't know if it builds a lot of drama for the big bad to get beat by a bunch of giant ants.
Other people have made that point, and they're just like, oh man, there's, you know, it's just like they're starting out Kang. He's got all these L's, but it, I mean, Jonathan Majors, that just, if you have a problem with it, just run back that scene with Cassie and Scott Lang, and like, this is a serious guy, yeah. Whatever variant it is. So he's a threat. He will always be a threat, regardless of what version it is.
Real quick, love the ending. Love the ending where Scott's just walking there, and he's like, normal day, and all of a sudden he gradually becomes more paranoid.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like, as his thing's going on, as the day's going on, he's becoming more paranoid and all that. I think it's an excellent character moment, and I think it's also typical Scott Lang. So I really enjoyed that moment.
Did you guys think, because, okay, the end of the movie we were talking about, you know, they have a fight, they got to get home, they end the portal, Scott and Kang have a big punch up, and then Evangeline Lilly kind of jumps in at the end to save it, and the portal, for a moment, closes. Did you guys think that, oh, they're just going to leave these guys there?
For a split second, but I didn't really think they would do that. They, you know, not only because it's an Ant-Man movie, but it would just be a weird ending for the third movie.
It'd be dark.
You know? Yeah.
I mean, you know, because I was thinking, okay, well, I mean, they're, you know, they are cycling some of these guys out, and, you know, they're safe.
But they're just going to leave them there?
You're right.
Do you want to do the after credits? We talked about the variants of Kang, showing up.
Yeah, I mean, it's the variants of Kang.
But the end credit one was definitely an interesting take.
So the end credit one, which in hindsight we should have seen coming, it's basically a prelude to Loki season 2, because Kang, or at least he who shall not be named, or whatever the guy's name is, you know, he's the main person at the end of Loki. And so we get to see our guy Loki and Mobius, whatever Wilson brother
is,
Owen Wilson is, and, you know, and another variant of Kang in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. So,
which one do you think it is? Do you think it's he remains, or do you think it's Kang the Conqueror?
When I was reading the Wikipedia summary afterwards, they called him Mr. Timely
or Victor Timely.
Victor Timely.
I don't know what variant that is.
Yeah. Do you think it's another Kang, or do you think it's He Who Remains, or do you think it's when the Conqueror got sucked up in that thing? Do you think he sent him back into the 1920s?
I don't know. I mean, that's the thing. With so many variants, it could be either or. So,
and that first credit scene where it's kind of like the Roman Forum and they're all jumping around, that was fantastic.
Yeah.
You know?
If you want Jonathan Majors,
yeah,
that's all the Jonathan Majors. You could give all the Jonathan Majors you'd ever want.
Yeah. So.
And he did it all perfectly, so, because Jonathan Majors is that damn good. So
why don't we go ahead and wrap this up? So, Keith, you got plugs.
All right. Well, you can reach us at moviesandemealog@gmail.com, moviesandemeal on Twitter, and do give us a listen, please, on iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so let's go ahead and wrap this up. So for Movies and Meal, I'm Ben.
And Keith.
It's Brad. Peace.
See you.